Good morning, Professor Nagel. Thank you very much for joining us. As we were just discussing, the theme of this series of interview is the history of replica symmetry breaking in physics, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. In our conversation with you, we will bleed a bit on both ends for context and for the future, and to talk a bit more about what happened afterwards. So to get us started, can you first tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
Oh, my family. My father was a philosopher, and my mother was a physicist and got a PhD in physics at a time when women were not supposed to get PhDs in physics. And so that was something I grew up with, and I saw what the strains were in the social strains that caused. So that was one aspect of growing up. My brother was a, or is a mathematician, and so he's the serious one in the family, and I went off into physics, so I wouldn't have to compete with him. I then went off into physics, but that was not actually the first thing I wanted to do in life. First thing I really wanted to do was be a poet, and so that kind of failed, and so I had to take second choice as a physicist. So and that's where I am now. And so
how did your interest for science came about? Was it just always in the air in a family, or was there a particular draw?
Well, it was, I actually was not interested in science when I started college. And I was, as I said, interested in literature. I guess two things happened there. One was I got kind of disillusioned with what we're supposed to be doing if we were studying literature. And the second thing was that I took a class that used this book by Purcell, which was the for a first year undergraduate's study of electricity and magnetism. And it was a beautiful book, and it was a struggle to get through for me, but I realized, oh, there's something really beautiful here, and maybe I should continue taking a little bit more. And so I took a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more. And that's, I still feel that I'm doing that now.
So what drew you to pursue graduate studies at Princeton and with Stephen Staderle in experimental condensed matter in particular?
Well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I went to graduate school. I mean, I thought maybe something along the lines of biological physics was something, but there wasn't too much going on at that point there. And so I started off working with someone in particle physics, and I realized I didn't like that aspect too much, because there seemed to be, even though the groups were really small in those days, they were too big for me. I mean, I still like to have, smaller scale things that I could work on. And so that was kind of the sociological aspect of it. I didn't know which areas, until you've done it, you don't really know what it's like. And so it was going into condensed matter, which is what Steve Schnatterly was doing. And so I knew I wanted to be an experimentalist. And the idea of condensed matter, what was very attractive and still remains very attractive to me, is that it's not so separated from theoretical or an experimental parts are not so far apart that you can't somehow be aware of both at any time that you're doing a problem. And so that was getting less and less true in particle physics, and is getting probably somewhat less true in some parts of condensed matter physics now as well. But the area that I'm in of soft condensed matter, it's beautiful that way, is that you're right in the middle of it, and it can do anything you want. And it's not so, what they like to call the field mature, if you can have a theory versus experimental part. And I always think of maturity as the last step before death. And so this is the part that, I like the fact that we're not a mature field, and so we have a ways to go before we have to partition ourselves off into different areas.
So this was really your perspective at the time you were a grad student? You were already aware of these subtleties, or?
Well, certainly, I don't think that soft condensed matter existed as a field when I was a graduate student. I mean, I never heard those words, certainly. There were things such as liquid crystals around, which I had heard of, but that was about it. The idea that you study disorder for disorder's sake was certainly not an accepted aspect of things. I mean, we were kind of taught that crystals were the be-all and end-all of everything, and so that was what why not deal with perfection all the time? And I didn't realize that perfection is also disorder. That was something that I only understood later. But there was this idea that physics was somehow supposed to study the things that we manufactured, and that's something that changed very much in my worldview of this, is that I really think that physics should be a study of what's out there, not what we can make out there conform to what we would like. And so that's why I think studying things like disorder or things that are not in equilibrium or anything that's a true mess is, if a physicist can come in and say something about that, the nature of that entity, then that I think is when they're doing their job the best.
So after your PhD, you went for postdoctoral studies with Jan Tauk at Brown.
Right.
On disorder, as we'll get to. So what brought you to Brown and with Jan Tauk in particular?
Well, Jan was what I was interested in those days, or I thought I could do, was optical properties. That's kind of what I did in graduate school, was something about optical properties. And Jan Tauk was he made his reputation with optical properties and in semiconductors, but that was kind of where he came from. And so that was what I was kind of interested in at the time, or thought I could work in at the time. I mean, you should realize that my self-confidence in coming out of graduate school was about yay big. And so I didn't really think I could contribute much to anything. And so that I could contribute much to, something to optical properties, I thought, oh, that would be neat if I could do that. And so that was kind of following a little bit along in the path that I had taken. But what Jan was really known for was amorphous semiconductors. And and so that was, not that I did any semiconductors at the time, but we did metallic glasses. That was what I worked on as a postdoc. And so that was my first taste of real disorder in terms of the glassiness.
So, yeah, I mean, as you were just saying, your first paper on glasses was that work with Tauk, and that work proposed a theory of metallic glass formability. what led to the genesis of this paper?
Gee, that's a long time ago. Question that was in the air at the time that we were trying to, you know, grapple with one way or another, is why were some materials able to form a glass and others not? Why were others always going to be, you know, they would always crystallize on you? And so there's this ability of these certain compositions of metallic alloys that formed glasses. And but you go off of that region and they don't so much. And so this, there have been a whole series of papers on this, basically from a, you know, some kind of packing point of view that, and now I'm a little bit hazy on what that was, but this was the group that was at Yale. So there was Cargill, Thorpe, Weir, and I forgot the last person, actually the most important for this, Polk. Polk was, and they were talking about different kinds of packing arrangements for why these things would work, because you would form certain kinds of cavities that the smaller particles could fall into and so forth. And this was the way that people were thinking about it at the time. And somehow I was kind of interested in the, you know, wedding what I knew about electronic structure with that. And so that just came naturally, was to think about it from that point of view and say, oh, well, there was an argument to be made that this was kind of energetically more favorable because of the energetics of the free electrons that would, you know, it was kind of one of the most beautiful ideas that I ran into at around that time, I thought, was the idea of charge density waves. I always thought that was just a lovely piece of physics that came in. And so in some sense, this was a riff on that, on those ideas. Why something could be more stable by opening up a gap near the surface, the Fermi surface.
So were these ideas that Jan Tauk was also interested in, or was this your curiosity building up?
Well, I don't think that Jan was, he didn't ever particularly, he certainly understood the importance of metallic glasses as a new kind of glass. And so he was interested in from that point of view. But his background was really very steeped in semiconductor physics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for semiconductors, you've got a gap there. And so the idea that with metals, you don't have a gap, and I'm not quite sure that he knew what kind of questions to be asking, but he was one of these people who had tremendous taste in choosing problems. And, you know, kind of, he smelt that there must be something there that's different and new, that's not there for the, so stepping away from what he had in semiconductor physics to go off to the metallics landscape. But I don't think he was interested in metals per se. I mean, that was probably not what his interest was, nor kind of looking at it from the metallic perspective or instabilities due to something like a charge density wave phenomena. But he certainly appreciated it when we talked about it. Mm-hmm.
So this work acknowledges conversation with Brian Bagley at Bell Labs.
Oh, yeah.
How close were you with the Bell Labs research group, and were you considering working there or moving to Bell Labs at all?
Jan came out of Bell Labs. So he was an emigre from Czechoslovakia who was in Bell Labs in 1968 at the time that the borders closed. And so he stayed there. And from Bell Labs, he then got his position at Brown. But my connection with Bell Labs is very far from the outside. I mean, they had no use for anything I was doing, or they ever wanted to see me. And, you know, so I've always felt, oh, looking into the candy store from outside, oh, that must be a great place, but I never got to see it. I mean, I did give a talk there because Jan arranged it, but that was, it was really not something that, much as I, whether I wanted to go to Bell Labs or not, was a moot point because they were not interested.
So what was the reception, the initial reception to that work on the theory of glass formability?
It was varied. I mean, so some people were intrigued. And some people were dead set against it. I mean, so one of the things is that the idea of how you could lower the energy is kind of an old one. I mean, it goes back to what was the I'm blanking on
Zeeman?
Jones, not Leonard Jones, but it'll come to me, but where, you know, that certain alloys were more stable because of, you know, where it placed a Fermi surface in the, in view of where the structure was. Jones, okay, so sorry, that's, but certain people, you know, so David Turnbull at Harvard, I remember, took it seriously, and he was a Mr. Glass at the time. I mean, he was Professor Glass. I mean, you know, it was, he was certainly a very senior figure in the field. Jan told me that Phil Anderson actually liked it. I know I did, but I was so out of it, I didn't even know who Phil Anderson was at the time. So, whoops, what does that say about me? You know, so I didn't realize that that was important. But people at Bell Labs, they didn't want, I mean, so I remember Brian Bagley was, you know, dead set against it because, you know, didn't conform to their views of structure formation. And so there was, but, you know, then the good question was always, well, how would you go about testing for something like this? And I think with all of these things, it's not particularly easy to figure out what a good test would be. That is, what is the experimental way in which you would go in and say, is this right or is that right? Which of these ideas? Because the energy changes could be quite subtle in order to give rise to, I mean, if you have something and it's in the exponent, then and a small change in the exponent can make big differences to what the energetics really are implying for the system. And so that was part of what that argument was about.
So can you you described already a bit the structure of the glass community, but can you tell us a bit how it worked at that point? Were there sort of key meetings where everyone attended, or was the or were there main questions that people were after?
There were a bunch of things that were kind of interesting at the time. I remember hearing a talk by Dennis Weir way back then, first then, and when he told us that no one really knew for sure that the hexagonal close pack or the FCC lattice was the most dense lattice. And I thought that was amazing, that that was a piece of thing that wasn't obvious to everyone. Why, how could you even go about proving that? And then I realized, oh, that's one of Hilbert's problems and goes back to Kepler and all of this stuff. And there's the rich history of this. And then, 10 years later, whatever, 15 years later, it was actually proved by Hales to have done this. And, so that was something which I'm not sure from the class community that that was an important thing, because I don't know that anything hung on that. But it kind of emphasized that even crystals, proofs about things having to do with crystals are, can be really knotty and difficult and hard to have a conclusion of definite satisfaction, right? I mean, that's the, that was one thing. But then there was a lot of stuff. There was one set of issues that came in because of a paper by Phil Anderson about having to do with when you have interactions between particles. And so slowly the ideas of interactions coming in to mediate, what the energies are like. There's when two particles are close by, and you can't start dealing with these things in a single particle picture. And that was, one of, I think, kind of the closer, first times that that question arrived for me. It probably rose for lots of people long before that, but this is where I hit this, because this was impinging on the glass community, and there was work then followed up closely later. I don't know if they were first or what, but by Mark Kastner and Helmut Fritzsche did something with valence alternation pairs as a way of, a concrete model for how to make that, see what the interactions could be. So that was one set of issues. And then there was a whole set of experiments that were done by the, I think it was the NIST group, but Taylor, Strom, and I've forgotten who that, but there were, on these same kind of issues. And so those were some of the issues, but those were all dealing with kind of the semiconductor aspects of this. And that was not something that, for whatever reasons, I didn't get into that, partly because I was working on the glass, on the metallic glass side of it. And so those issues weren't in the fore there. But I think they became more in the fore for the amorphous semiconductor areas.
So once you joined Chicago, you became mostly free to choose your own research problems, right, as an assistant professor. How did you select topics of interest? What was sort of driving your program initially?
How honest do you want me to be?
As honest as you can.
Oh, damn. Okay. Well, look, it started out really tough. I mean, I got here, and you're not supposed to say this out loud, but I got here, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. I mean, of course, I knew what I had done, and I was given a certain funding for my startup funds, and I spent them on something having to do with photo emission, And I realized when it came that I didn't want to do that. I had no interest in doing that. And this was, you know, I was really trying to get rid of my career as quickly as you could possibly do it and end up in the waste can of it. And so I gave all that stuff away to colleagues. Because my senior colleagues were all looking at it and saying, why aren't you doing something with this? I don't know why it was their business, but they felt it was. So I didn't follow the line that I thought I was going to. And I sat for months just looking at the window, trying to figure out what is it that I wanted to do. And it was not a pleasant time. Slowly I realized, well, I was kind of interested in a kind of a flexible lab. That is, I didn't want to be tied down to one big machine the way so many experimentalists do get tied down. And so the kind of stuff we did was, I should just say flexible. That is, I could use the same apparatus, the electronics of various kinds that I could do measure one thing with or another thing with, but it didn't require a specific idea that we're going to do the same thing over and over again with different samples. So we started off with doing kind of transport in metallic glasses, and from that I got into trying to say, oh, well, how about relating that to the structure? Because the ideas that I had about, you know, metallic glasses, and I said it was kind of like a charge density wave, those ideas, but that required knowing where the structure was with respect to the electronics, but the electronic structure and the mechanical, the particle structure of the systems would be related, and see if we could see something about that. So that was kind of what we started doing. And then there are a few other things, but just in the terms of the glassiness aspect, started doing spectroscopy. And so the dielectric response of this. And this is, that became something that was, you know, I didn't realize where it would go, but it was a, we use it as a tool to do spectroscopy, which I don't think is exactly the way people had thought of it before. That is, so that we could, even with, we were able to cover, I forget how many years it took us to do this, but it was a bunch of years, but we did this. So we had something like 14 decades or something close to 14 decades of frequencies that we covered. And with that, you could really see that there were different aspects to the relaxation spectrum of supercooled liquids as they were cooling. And you could look at different aspects of this and different frequency regions. You could see what was going on. And so it really was kind of going back to what we had done, or I learned about as a graduate student, which was optical properties. That is, you can see that different signatures of the electronic structure appear in different frequency ranges. And so that's kind of what came from this. And so, that you have the whole spectrum. And so you have Kramers-Kronig relations that tell you the real and imaginary parts are related. And you can use those to figure out something about what the what's happening at zero frequency, if you know enough about if we've covered all those decades of frequency, we can use that to get something about zero frequency. And so we showed something there that I'm still fighting the same battle, and it's 25 years later. I mean, as you guys heard, I had to fight this with your good buddy Jean-Philippe, at the Solvay conference. I mean, that, you know, it couldn't possibly be right. But it predicts the same things that they found much later in the same thing and with the same scale of stuff. And, you know, but they just don't want to believe it because it's linear response. It's not fancy theory land. Sorry, I know you're both theorists, and so I should be careful about what I say. But there's this bias that has come through that, and don't look at the bias. You look at what the data says, and if you look at this, you see that there's something going on here which is very odd and different from what would have been expected, and actually predicted that there was a temperature at which not only the relaxation stopped, which is what people had used with the, you know, a vocal fulcher law, for example, and where the Kasman temperature was, which is what where you think the entropy is going away, but also that there is a length scale. And that's what this says, because there's a static susceptibility, which is divergent. And it's at the same temperature, and all of the stuff should be about the same. And so this was a battle that, you know, we were able to show this. And, you know, and I still feel like I'm fighting for legitimacy of that result, even 25 years later. I mean, so that's one of the things that we did at that time. But so, then that got into other kinds of relaxation. Yeah, sorry.
No, I'd like to take you back a bit. I mean, Morrow Cohen was working on a theory of glasses at the time you joined also. How much did you interact with him on glasses?
Oh, well, Morrow was wonderful. I mean, so, you know, I'm not sure, you know, he was, I don't know how, you know, just mentioning Morrow's name makes me smile because of all the stories that took place at the time. Of just dealing with Morrow, and so you know, what was he like? I mean, so he was really I don't think he had a mean bone in his body. I mean, he was very but he certainly also thought well of himself, and so it was both things at the same time, which is not always But, you know, so just the story, just because where else will I get to tell the story? So here I was, a young assistant professor, first year, scared, didn't know what end was what. And Morrow was taking a whole group of people out for dinner with a speaker. And in the middle of this, this dinner, which was people all around the table, he stops the conversation with everybody and he turns to me, "Sid, you're from Manhattan. How come you're not more sophisticated?" And, you know, that was, you know, 40 years ago or more, and I'm still trying to figure out an answer to that, and I have not come up with one yet. But so that's a moral story, which is you're asking for science, and I'm giving you tidbits, but that was so be it. So look, you asked about how I interacted with Morrow. So
science wise as well, right? If there's any, if in any way was there science between the two of you?
Yeah. So look, we talked about things, and you know, he certainly took an interest in what we're doing. And he left soon after. I've forgotten exactly when he was there versus when I did various things, because he left to go to Exxon mm-hmm. at some point, not too far after I got there. So he was interested with Gary Grest in doing the free volume theory of glasses, and it was certainly it was interesting because they were doing this, and it legitimized that question as a good question to be asking what was going on. What I found about it, I think, was that I didn't really know what to do with the theory. That is, okay, so they have this, and it looked like every time they wanted to get something, they had to put something else in to begin with to get it to come out, you know, which is maybe the way certain theories will go, but it didn't give a slam dunk thing of, when if you do this, you can say something concrete about it. And so it was also the fact that I don't think of theory's job as to go in and say, okay, which is correct and which is not correct. I mean, that may be something that comes as a byproduct of what experiment does, but experiment is where you find new ways of looking at nature. You're not there to correct what other people are thinking about nature. You're there to come out and figure, okay, did you know that nature is doing this? And this is a different way of looking at it than you would have thought otherwise. And so that's kind of what came out of that dielectric response stuff that I was telling you about. That is, it showed that there was a whole new class of phenomena that had, you didn't really expect to be there. And so that was, I think experiment and theory work best when they are kind of both independent and then touch base with each other at crucial times, but not. But I don't know that there was ever a crucial time that the free volume theory and our experiments had a way of touching base. But
I mean, you did nevertheless start to collaborate with Gary Grest and Anazir Rahman on molecular simulations of glasses.
That actually started before Marl and Gary were working, I think.
Okay.
And so I was doing this with Gary while he was still here. And then I think Gary and Marl kind of started working more together, either towards the end of Gary's time or after Gary had left as a postdoc to gone to Purdue. So
how did that collaboration begin? How did you get involved in numerical simulations then?
If any of you have ever met Anis Rahman, you would be lucky people, because Anis was a wonderful person, and you were around him, and you just you just felt life was fun. I mean, he had the beauty of the stuff that he was doing, and that was and he made it. He was a very important scientist, but he was just great to be a mentor to someone like me. I've been blessed with having certain mentors in my life who were that, and certainly Jan Tautz, who I mentioned, and Anis Rahman were two of them who were at that stage, kind of helped me along. Of someone who was more contemporaneous with me, it would be Tom Witten, who I would also want to say, but we were kind of more the same age, rather than, he was just a little bit older, not a very senior person. So those were the people who were really important. Leo Kadanoff later, not quite to the same level as Anis and Jan. These were people who were important. Your question was what I've got off on.
How did it come about? I mean, did you reach out to them? Did they find out about you?
I reached out to Anissa. That is what I was. Okay, so I remember what I was interested in doing, which was I'd heard about two level systems in Glassy stuff, and so I thought, oh, we could go out and look for them in these systems. That was what the initial stuff was. And you know, so other people were doing similar things. Stillinger and Weber were doing this at Bell Labs and so forth. And they went off into their thing with the lowest energy state, the structure of
inherent structures.
Inherent structures, right? And so we thought that we could do that. We didn't know they were doing it, but we each got sidetracked by our own things. And so Gary and I got sidetracked was with echoes. And so this was the thing that we did there, which was we want to get to very, very low temperatures. And so to be able to look at the inherent structures, so this was what we were. And so we were just doing ordinary MD. We weren't doing something fancy with, we weren't doing steepest descent or anything. We were just doing molecular dynamics. And so we, quenched the system. That is, we set all the velocities to zero. But of course, the potential energy wasn't zero, so then the temperature started to rise again. And so then we let it go, and then we hit it to zero again. And it rose again. Because, and then, lo and behold, there was something at the same time after our first, this time between the two quenches that we gave it, the temperature was going along and then had a dip and started to come back. And I remember this was the first time I just thought, oh, this was so lovely. This was, I'd had a professor in undergraduate who had been interested in echoes. He was one of the people who had discovered the photon echo, so Sven Hartman. And so I had a class from him where he had talked about those. And I always thought echoes were one of the most beautiful phenomena that you could have. And here it was that we were able to see this kind of echo in this system, and who would have thought? And then we checked it and it had all of the kinds of things. And so that was kind of where that came from. And then, of course, well, it's an echo, and so what do you do with it? And so we tried to figure out what we could do with it. But that was kind of what Anise and Gary and I were did. And I'm not sure, it interrupted us going towards the important questions in glasses about low temperature states and so forth. But I think it was probably computers weren't up in those days, up to the task of really looking for tunneling states. And this was a in-your-face phenomena that was something that was made me very happy. And so I was just, I'm not sure it was very important, but it was made me happy, which was important to me.
So how did this work logistically? Were you writing code at the time, or were you?
Gary was, until we had done this, Gary and I had started something earlier than that, which was on, I've forgotten what, we were looking for tails and distribution of something. I'd have to look it up. I've forgotten what, but that was the first thing that Gary and I had done was to, and I think it had to do with This is while he was a postdoc. This other second set of stuff was after he had gone off to Purdue that we worked on that. Oops. Can you hold the line half a sec? I just had someone's at the door. Sorry.
Yes. So, yeah. I mean, I was asking you, how did this collaboration work?
So Anis was out at Argonne, and I was here, and so Argonne is 30 minutes away by car. And Anis knew I had a sweet tooth, and so he would buy a whole box of Twinkies and put it down next to the computer, so that I would come out there more often. And so this was how the collaboration took place. And so he was working with Michele Parinella at the time, and so that was also someone else in Anis's orbit. So he was working on, Michele was doing really important stuff, but Anis still found time to work with us on these echo phenomena. So that was.
But were you doing your own coding, or was there a technician doing the coding?
So a lot of the coding, I did some of it, but a lot of the coding was already done by Anis had already made glasses. With McTaig and Anis, and so there was some density of states of glasses that existed, and so that was so I kind of worked with that and just fiddled with some of the peripherals around the edge of that of the code.
I see.
So you don't want to ask me to do any coding. I mean, that's for sure.
But this was a Fortran base, presumably.
Yeah, a Fortran base. As well, there were still computer cards.
Assembly.
It was not, we didn't have screens. I mean, those came in during that thing. So, it was, okay.
So what was your general impression of numerical simulations at that time?
I loved it. I thought they were nice, always had to be a little defensive because the world did not like computer simulations much. I mean, they thought this was it's theory, but not real theory or something. And I never saw it as theory. I always saw it as an experiment. And so it really was kind of bucking the trend of as an assistant professor, I was called into the front office and told, we didn't hire you to do this theory junk. We hired you to be an experimentalist, so go be experimentalist. And so I thanked them very much and went back to doing what I was doing because I didn't know how to do anything else. I mean, but it was what I was interested in, so I just followed that. So I don't know if that answers the question, but at the time, simulation didn't get that much respect, although people were clearly intrigued. I don't, quickly it caught on. It's just at the beginning, it was, where does this stand in the pantheon of what's worth doing, right? Or what does it show you?
So can you describe a bit the simulation community at that point in the early to mid 80s? I mean, were you regularly discussing with other simulators like Hans Andersen, Jean-Pierre Hansen, Dave Thermalay, Ray Mountain, and et cetera?
No, well, I met some of them. I still, to this day, never met Dave Thermalay. So I've never met him, but I met some of the others at the time, and certainly Hans Andersen I met, and there are various people, and they were, I mean, but I was not really in that community. I mean, I just happened to be doing something with them, and I had the great good fortune of working with Anise, and so I never thought of myself as a trying to belong to the simulation community. It was just that that was what I was doing. You know, so Anise would tell me, "Oh, did you know that Hans Andersen has figured out how to do constant pressure ensembles and so forth?" And oh, that was interesting, but I didn't hear that because I went to conferences or anything. It was that I heard it because I worked with someone who was ahead of that field. I mean, I think everyone looked up to Anise, is my impression. I mean, again, I wasn't the other people, but somehow my impression of and how I felt about it ever since is whenever you say the word Anise, everybody acknowledges that he was one of the main instigators of that whole area. And you know, there were other people like Stillinger who were there, and Stillinger was I did meet him at one of the few times I went to Bell Labs, and he really tried to give me a hard time until Phil Anderson told him to shut up and let the guy speak. So I thought, oh, that was nice. And so it's we can see that. Okay.
In the early 90s, you specifically studied the question of a static correlation length in numerical simulations of glasses. What brought you to this particular question and this method for study?
Well, it was, okay, now I don't exactly, I hope I've got the thing in the right order, but the static correlation length was something that the simulations would have, dielectric response stuff indicated there was something like this. And so this was in the mid 90s, I think, probably not early 90s, but but certainly the question has always been, if there's a phase transition, you want some evidence of a length scale, not just a time scale, coming in. And so that was the issue. And so we had tried to do a three, you know, I'm say three omega, but I mean, you know, higher order correlation function, the third order correlation function. And, you know, we finally got to see something. And then when we stopped and we looked at it and realized, the size of the signal would have been, that we were seeing would have been if the plates had been moving by an angstrom. And we decided, that's not, you can't trust that. We never published anything about that. But it was something that we were trying to do because that was how people had seen this in the spin glass literature, is looking at that. This was one of the things that we were trying to study, trying to define that, and so look at it in the simulations as well. What those showed was that, I mean, over the range that we were able to do measurements, we weren't going to be able to do simulations. We weren't able to see anything, but we could set up the expression for how to do it, but it didn't kind of show the phenomena that but we learned how to get the energy to be conserved to all those last decimal points. I mean, that was, we learned that part of how to do it. And the other part that I should point out is, I mentioned the dielectric response. I should have said the other thing that was maybe more important was the doing the time-dependent specific heat. And that was the experiments that we did there to learn how to do, to invent that kind of spectroscopy where you do frequency dependent specific heat, and you can see that the heat modes are going in at different frequencies. There's and so it's like a spectroscopy, just like a dielectric response, but dielectric response is just infinitely easier to do and more precise. But settled some issues as to what the what the specific heat was doing in these systems. So that was another aspect. I should have mentioned that when I talked about what we started off doing, because that was an early point.
You mentioned spin glasses. How closely were you following the spin glass conversation, and how did you follow that conversation, if at all?
Well, I was aware it was around. We certainly, I didn't know what to make of it, really. That is, to what extent are these the same or different kinds of phenomena? And to be honest, I still don't really know the answer to that. I was aware, enough of that if you wanted to see something, you really had to do you wait longer and things get sharper. You wait longer still and they get sharper, but you're never going to win by just going in that direction. So then there was the work by the Bell Lab people, Laura Levy, who had done the higher order susceptibility and showing how that did have a sharp peak in it that grew. And so this was something that, that's what made us think about trying to do the regular glasses, but we didn't get, we were not successful at that. But what it did do was that we went off to, with Tom Rosenbaum, who was here at the time, we did some spin glass stuff, trying to do the same thing. And again, for the same battle that we have with the linear response in the glass community, showing that there's evidence for some kind of a divergent susceptibility. There's also evidence in the lithium homium yttrium fluoride glasses that Tom looked at. These are the dipolar glasses, there was a similar type of behavior. That you could see effects in the linear response that you could that could tell you where the transition temperature was going to be, and you could. What was nice about that case was that you could actually go and measure where the spin glass temperature was, because you could also do the nonlinear susceptibility there. And so, but again, that's part of this 25-year thing where we're still, that ever be straightened out as to exactly why we can see things when the prevailing view of theorists, I think, is, oh, you shouldn't see it, and therefore don't even pay attention to it.
But so your interactions with Levy and with, say, Ray Horbach also was working. Was this all through the paper trails, or were these conversations?
I don't know if I ever met Lauren Levy, but I did know Ray. And Ray was actually very good to me as a very young guy coming out. And so I want to, he invited me out to Bell Labs, to UCLA, when I was just a youngster, starting off my assistant professorship, and because he knew some of the work I had done at Brown with Jan Tautz, and so he has been I don't think we've talked much in the past 20 years so much about things, but at early on he was someone who was one of the few who seemed to take what I had to say seriously. And so I always appreciated that.
So in the 1996 study of the frequency domain physical aging in a simple liquid, you found a qualitative agreement with spin glasses. And in that work, you acknowledged conversations with Leticia Colliandolo and Jorge Corchan. How did these interactions and your appreciation of spin glass ideas take place?
What year was that, did you?
96, it was published.
96, okay. So I'm a little confused about this. I certainly got to know Leticia and Jorge when we ran the jamming workshop. What used to be ITP, now KITP.
That's before.
And so this seems to be just a little before. So now I'm forgetting where I would have run into them. I remember. Yeah, okay. There was a conference that they held someplace in Europe. I remember being there, and I've forgotten what the venue was, but I remember they were talking about waiting time studies. We talked a little bit about that, and I thought, hey, I can do that. We've got the stuff in glasses. They were talking in spin glasses, per se. And so that came before the ITP workshop, because I remember getting up and telling everybody there is this ITP workshop coming. So that the timing is about right for that. So I think that's where I learned about it. I was at a conference with them, and there was a whole European group of theorists there. I mean, so there was Giorgio Parisi was there, I'm pretty sure Jean-Philippe was there, Bouchot, now I'm a little bit vague as to who others, but I remember it was those who was trying to understand what the meaning of the slow relaxation was, and how that interacted with the waiting time behavior.
So was that your first time interacting with that community at that point, or you'd been in touch?
Probably. I think that probably is right. I don't think, I mean, there was the other community which has not been mentioned, which was Goethe's,
Mode Goethe's coupling.
The mode coupling. And so that was going on a lot at that time. And that was the ones that was probably much more prevalent in our understanding from over here at the time. I mean, that those were, I had a colleague, Gene Mazenko, who was part of that kind of group of people studying mode coupling. And again, I had a lot of trouble with that because I couldn't figure out how experiments related to what they saw. And and here I had wonderful conversations with Dan Kivelson, who was part of that glass community at the time. We talked about that a fair amount to try and figure out what could or couldn't be said about.
In the review, you wrote that, Francesco, you wanted to?
Yeah, sorry, I just wanted to be sure. So before the mid-90s, so before this conference that you mentioned, so on, I'm not sure I understood how you were interacting with the spin glass community of the, let's say during the 80s. So would you attend conferences or sessions, for example, in big meetings where people were talking about spin glasses, or how did it work?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a long time ago, so I'm trying to remember. But I don't know how I even got invited to this one in that I did mention. And I don't know whether you guys were there. Do you remember this back in?
I was in high school, so.
could have been there. You could have been there. I mean, it's. I should have been in high school. I'd be so much happier now if I'd been in high school then. But I've never really been, I don't know. I was certainly never part of that spin glass community. I mean, I was kind of involved in a variety of other types of things. I mean, during that time, there was some work that was on the glassy stuff and the susceptibilities and doing that. But at the same time, I was also trying to understand the Aronoff Bohm effect in these weak localization systems in 2D. It didn't have to be 2D, but weak localization effects and how that's related to some symmetries that, you know, you could see this very simply in terms of the symmetry argument, which had kind of gotten made opaque by doing these very sophisticated calculations. And if you just looked at really, really small systems, you could see why you had to have that symmetry. There's even an odd number of particles system. So we had been doing things like this, and so that, you know, but I mean, I've never really been a member of any of these communities, and I was always kind of on the external to them. And
I was interested in your point of view, because you were doing things that were related to what people were doing in spin glasses, but you were not like a member of the community. So I wanted to understand how the spin glass community was kind of irradiating or not outside, you know, the inner circle of people who were doing spin glasses 100% of their time. So it seems that I think one possibility is that during the 80s and early 90s, spin glass people were mostly focused on equilibrium properties and equilibrium dynamics. And maybe the mid-90s were the moment where off equilibrium entered the game. And so maybe that's why people started to make connections with other out of equilibrium systems. But I don't know if this is correct. So
yeah, maybe I'm interested in hearing what you have to say, because I haven't thought about this if it hasn't been obvious, I haven't thought back for a long time on this period of time. But I mean, there are a couple of things that were going on right then. So if we're talking about end of 80s, beginning of 90s and so forth, one other preoccupation that we had was going into granular matter, into sand piles. And so that was also part of there were some of the same actors there. So there was the work that Mike Cates and Jean-Philippe Bouchot did about, are the equations elliptic, hyperbolic, parabolic equations and so forth, about force chains going down to the bottom of a sand pile and so forth. And, I remember being on the outside of that conversation and trying to understand what they were saying. And be honest, I didn't get very far. And I'm not sure that it ever went very far after that, but it was a big hullabaloo in the field at the time as they were trying to work this out, the physicists against the engineers. And it wasn't the best time for either group, I think. I don't think it was a plus. But the point for us was that the glasses and the granular material had a lot of things in common. And what was interesting about that was that I had all these friends who did simulations. I mean, so, it wasn't that I was doing simulations, but all my best buddies were doing simulations. And they all seemed to be doing the same thing, but then I have to ask them, well, are you doing a glass or are you doing granular material? And I had to ask them that because it wasn't obvious from what they were doing. And it was by realizing that they were both doing these things that these things really have to be connected in some deep way. And that's what kind of brought about the ideas of jamming, is that it came through this realization that, oh, all these people are doing these things, they're doing the same things, but not really realizing it. Some of these things are, you're asking specifically about where the spin glass stuff came in. And probably I was more aware of the experimental stuff than the theoretical stuff. That is, enough to know why you want the higher order susceptibility. Okay, that's a kind of theoretical argument, but this is what people do to measure it, and this is what they see, and so forth. And so I got that. But what I really wanted to know about these things, and this is what I think has been, as you've heard me say often before, so I want to know, if we do all this theoretical work, what does it have to tell me about experiments? And if it doesn't, not that it's wrong, it's just that it's probably not going to be what I'm catching, right? The fact that you have all of these wonderful results about, infinite dimensions or replica symmetry breaking and so forth, those are words to me until I say, oh, this is what I can actually do to, I get it. This is, and so that's kind of been the, why I always feel totally inferior when I talk to you guys, because, I'm not catching all the important ideas, but I do have it through this particular lens of where they're going to make an impact on me and Margaret. So I don't know if that's apologetic enough, but I'm very sorry, but that's why.
It's okay. But so for some reason, the work of, let's say, Cugliandolo and Kurchanov, I don't want to talk specifically about them, but the moment when people started talking about aging and dynamics, this resonated somehow better with your interest and your...
Because it was something I could see. I mean, that was, as I recall, coming away from that conference, I said, oh, they do this and they should see this kind of behavior after the waiting time. And, well, I can do that. I have to say I didn't, I'm not saying that I understood what the theory was, but I said, well, I can certainly do an experiment on that. It was along the lines of what we were doing anyway, so it was an easy add-on to it. And Bob has continued some of that, but I didn't do more than that after he left as a grad student.
A bit on that theme, when you wrote the very, we now know to be very influential review in Supercold Liquids and Glasses in 1996, you do refer to, in your conclusion, to spin glasses as important model systems, which are being studied theoretically and are analogous to structural glasses in some respect. Was the intuition or the enthusiasm for spin glasses coming directly from that conference you had attended? Or was this a more general perspective?
I think it was probably more general. I think, we'd all heard about spin glasses and the ideas from spin glasses for a long, long time. I mean, and this conference was one of the places where I got to hear about some specific ideas that had resonance and so forth. But certainly, I think, we all thought that spin glasses were going to be the simpler model of glasses. And why did we think that? Well, very smart people have told us that they would be. And so how could they not be? Now I realize maybe that's not the case, but I'm beginning to rethink what is the relationship between these and what makes them same and what makes them different. Certainly at that time, that was in the air. And it had been in the air since the 70s. I mean, that wasn't a new thing to come about. But I remember I think I'm remembering this right, but remember on my flight from Providence to Chicago, when I was coming from my job, I heard about spin glasses and wondering, what are these things? And is it going to be really the simplified view of this? And I remember it was some trip that I took between the two, and it could have been a little bit later, but it was something that was in the air. It was glassiness in a simplified system, and therefore could be could be the basis on which things were to be understood. So I don't think that came later. I mean, that was somehow, we all believed it in some, but didn't know what particularly to do with it, but it was.
So a group that made that connection quite explicitly in the late 80s was Kirkpatrick, Thermalye, and Wolness. How influential were these ideas on experimental research on structural glasses, from your standpoint, or from on you, I mean, directly?
I understand that work is tremendously important now for our understanding. I don't know. I mean, I can't say that it influenced our experimental work. But it's also true that we had kind of done what we were, we'd gone into this field and we had done something in that. We had spent a long time doing that something. And, we did the specific heat spectroscopy part, and we did the dielectric response stuff. And those were two fairly long drawn out experimental things. And, you know, I'm not quite sure, well, if I continue with those, I'm not quite sure what I would want to do with that. That is that really the you know, more interesting to me was getting into the granular stuff around that time, so the late 80s, early 90s. So I forget, what time was the Walness Kirkpatrick thermion?
Late 80s, 87 to 89.
So it was around that time that, that our interests were beginning to shift a bit from that. And so...
But so maybe before, maybe just a very last question on this before we move on to the granular part. So you gave a talk at the March meeting in 1996, and the title was "Is there a glass transition similarities with spin glasses?" So I was curious. I mean, do you recall what was the content of the talk and what was the discussion around it? How people reacted to it and so on. So what was the idea at the time?
Can you give me the title again?
The title was "Is there a glass transition similarities with spin glasses?"
Oh, okay. So look, I don't remember to be honest, but my guess is what we were doing around that time was this thing I already mentioned, which was we look at the susceptibility over a wide range of frequencies, and we can see the tail, and we can see. And so it's a spectroscopy. We can focus in on the tail and see what the tail does as a function of temperature. And so we're getting something about that. And there was that indicated at some point the tail would become flat. And when the tail becomes flat, and if it goes all the way down to zero frequency, then we have a divergence susceptibility. And so this was that part. Also at that time, we had the stuff I mentioned with Tom Rosenbaum's lithium homing yttrium fluoride spin glasses, which showed in the linear susceptibility of that there was similar structure. So I think what I know there was a period around that time that's what I was trying to get people to realize is that there is something that is analogous in the two. Not exactly the same because the structures are they appear in different places, but they are both low frequency phenomena that are coming in different ways, but where the linear susceptibility is having this weird divergence, not because there is a peak in omega epsilon double prime or chi double prime. It's not a sharp peak in the absorption part. It's that there is a very, very, very broad behavior of that. And the integral over that broad behavior is what's giving you the linear part. And that's why it's so hard to see in some sense, and why you have to work harder to be able to gather that spectrum to be able to see how the integral over it produces something. So I think that was the picture that I recall at that time trying to push, and so that may have been what that talk was about.
As you've alluded to a couple of times already, in the late 80s, you start to be interested in granular systems, and this work was done in collaboration with Tom Witten and Heinrich Jäger, at least initially. How did this new direction come about in your lab or in that group?
Well, it was you all know Tom. Tom is great. Tom was coming from Exxon. He was just starting, he was going to start at Chicago a few years later, I guess. I knew Tom since I was a graduate student. And so it was always fun to talk science with him. And so he told me about the self-organized criticality type of arguments. And he was still at Exxon at the time. And so that was at the back of my head. And I was getting a new postdoc, which was Heinrich Geiger at the time. And so Heinrich was a postdoc. And so I suggested to Heinrich, should we try this? And Heinrich was game. And so we did this. And so we started to look at avalanches in granular materials to look at through kind of power law correlations or whatever it's kind of. And so Tom wasn't, Tom had been, told us about the theory, but he was not involved in those experiments. He was involved in a later paper having to do with trying to understand friction in these systems, the role of friction. But so this was the first paper on that was Relaxation at the Angle of Repose. I mean, one of the titles I'm most proud of is that, to look at the what kind of spectrum comes out of the avalanches of a system. And this had been very much popularized by Per Bach, Chow Tang, and Kurt Wiesenfeld, particularly by Per Bach, who is not known for being shy about his work. And this was supposed to be the theory of everything. How Nature Works was his book on topic. And what we found was that there was no power law of distribution of avalanche sizes. It was relaxation oscillation. It was just it was a first order phase transition. And so that was part of what, you haven't mentioned the sign I have above my lab door or on our website, which is experiment where theory comes to die, is really, this was one of the cases where I remember theorists would come in and we would show them what was going on. I would have an example on my desk to show them, see, move it like this, and suddenly there's an avalanche, and then nothing as you move it more and more and more till there's another avalanche. And they say, oh, it's got to be wrong. The theory says this. And I, no, wait a minute, we've got this wrong. I mean, it's not what the theory says, it's the, what does experiment tell us? And so this was something which was, it made me realize there's this supremacy in the world of theory over experiment, and I have to do my best to battle that to show that not only is what the experiments the important thing and the right thing, but it's also where the new ideas come as well. So of course I'm overstating this because it comes from everywhere, but it gets forgotten that it comes from an experiment. That's why I feel my job is to push that more. But
so you mentioned earlier how you seeing the analogy between people studying glasses and people studying granular systems and essentially looking at the same systems, asking the same questions, made you realize that there was a bridge that was missing. And that's what led to the organization of the ITP workshop, I guess, in 97. So can you tell us a bit about how that came about with the organizers, Sam Edwards, Andrea Liu, and Mark Robbins?
I had been talking about these ideas with people here at Chicago, and those at the time, that was Tom Witten and Sue Coppersmith, they were here. And so they both encouraged me to send this, start a ITP workshop. So I'm not sure I would have thought of doing that myself. But so I put that in. And I remember right in the middle of the NBA playoffs, how could they do this to me? The NBA playoffs of the Bulls versus probably the Sixers, I don't know, at the time. I get a call from the chair of the KITP or the ITP board saying, well, we can't let you do this because you're an experimentalist. So we need to get another theorist to help on this. And so how about Andrea? And so I said, sure. Just shut up and let me go back to watching the Bulls game. So that's how it came. I mean, they did not want to have an experimentalist run that because they did not think an experimentalist could do it. And so that was, and then once we had Andrea and I together, that was a great thing. And so I'm very delighted by that. But then we brought in Sam and Mark. But it started off with Andrea and myself.
I mean, did you know Andrea from before? Why?
I've met her a few times, but I didn't really know her. I mean, but I met her at Los Angeles, UCLA.
UCLA.
I probably met her at Exxon when she was a postdoc there, but that wasn't we weren't buddies in any sense then, and we hadn't really started doing it. Our collaborations really started after the workshop was over. We worked hard to put the workshop on and make it good together, but we didn't really have research plans together until afterwards.
In an interview you gave earlier this year, you described, you mentioned how not serious that work was perceived, at least at the beginning, and maybe even by you. When did it turn serious in your mind, granular work?
That's kind of a hard question. I'm not sure I've ever thought of anything I do as serious. I mean, that's so to the extent to which I get to go against that. I always thought, there was framing the work in terms of self-organized criticality that seems serious because, how could it not be? Theorists have said something good about it. What I realized, so we did that work, so Heinrich and I and the student Chuheng Yu worked on that, and we published on that. And then that was kind of over, right? There's nothing to be more to be done. I mean, see the avalanches, and they're not what they say. But in doing so, we had seen so many other phenomena in this. And I remember sitting down saying, look, I can drop this and go back to doing other stuff. Or I can say, no, this is something interesting here, and the whole thing is behaving in weird ways. And what can we do to, should we follow that up? And I remember just sitting and saying, I don't want to be the kind of physicist who is just going to be, I just jump on something for a one-time thing and be off and because that was an easy pickings thing. I mean, it should be done with a certain sense of seriousness to this. So, so the sense of non-seriousness that I had was probably always because the inferiority complex of, well, if I'm doing it, it can't be serious. I mean, that's but that was true about everything I've ever done. But but I don't think it was done any, if I think back to that time, I remember that afternoon thinking about it. But that was a kind of a serious discussion I had with myself. I mean, how could I not take this? You can't just see these things and pretend they don't exist and then say everything else is interesting. And it wasn't as if I was doing something else I felt was more interesting. I mean, I saw this stuff and, well, is there a way of looking at it? And what was surprising to me is, you look back on this and says, well, that's an obvious question. That's an obvious question. That's an obvious question that we asked. But at the time, I had no idea what the right obvious questions were to ask. And so somehow it took a while. Oh, sound in granular material. What is that like? That's kind of obvious, right? You might want to ask that, but no, it didn't. It took a while. Or how does tapping make this thing collapse? Again, kind of obvious now, but it wasn't obvious to us then. And what we liked was somehow to be able to ask some of these questions that we thought could then have larger ramifications. That is, the stuff with the tapping, that started off with just tapping this thing, and we had it on but right here. It's been around for a while. I mean, this thing, you just tap it and it goes down and it goes down and goes down some more, and to make an experiment out of that, we didn't think it would be too hard, but it took a long time to do it. But then it was after doing that we realized, oh, you can actually begin to test things like the Edwards compactivity or temperature, whatever you want to call that idea, because it's fluctuation dissipation theorem about specific heat and volume fluctuations and temperature, and we can measure volume fluctuations, therefore we could get the temperature and we could see if it made sense. I mean, so that was again, I wish I could say, oh, we knew that we could from the beginning that was what we would be doing. No, it was that slowly, we would see the stuff, we would see what you could do with this, what was nature trying to tell us you could do with it, and then thinking about it and realize, oh, there's this is how to think about it so that you can put it into the language of statistical mechanics or other kinds of physical systems.
So your exposure to Edwards Ensemble, did that come from the ITP workshop as well? Or this that came back? Yeah.
No, I knew about that for longer. Anita Mehta had come through Chicago earlier on. And so this must have been in the 80s, I would guess. I've forgotten when I first met her, but she came through. And she came from Sam's group. Sir Sam's group, and certainly I knew about it then, if not before. But that
just not gone into the design of the experiment. It's after seeing the phenomenon that you became.
That was not. Who would have said, oh, that's how you're going to measure this? I'm not smart enough to have thought of that. But it was that we thought, oh, well, this is something to how long does it take to reach equilibrium? That's something that's glassy. That's a glassy question, right? There's time scales. And so that's where I was coming from, was from the time scale part. This is part of why I saw these two things as part of the same kinds of questions.
So as you were mentioning earlier, after the ITP workshop, you started collaborating with Andrea. Can you tell us a bit how the program was shaped at that point. What the questions were you pursuing in the immediate aftermath, and what was the project?
What was it that we were trying to do in the program? I mean, it was, you've got the field of people doing granular material. And so we brought those there. We had people who were doing glasses, and you brought them there. And can you get them to talk to one another? And they're polite, but they didn't truly engage. You know, there's what is the, you know, and so, you know, we had lots of things, and it was a good workshop because people did pay attention, but they, I think everybody was a bit confused as to, is, what are we supposed to be doing? I mean, give me something to calculate, or give me something, you know, it wasn't that we were trying to ask, is there a different way of looking at these phenomena? And so that's kind of what we were trying to do. And there were, you know, some people there who, you know, really pitched in and were very useful. I mean, two of them were Shlomo Alexander and Tom Witten. And I think, you know, exactly how things went from there, but we were, I think we left the program, think, well, that was kind of fun, but the ideas percolated or sat around, and then they began to attract each other. And so I think the thing that was, and so this is myopic, so it's from my point of view, other mm-hmm. people probably feel differently, sure. But it was, Andrea and I were asked to look at this paper by Mike Cates and company about jamming, and you know, we were trying to figure out what the hell this has to say. But during trying to figure out what to say, we came up with the idea of the phase diagram, and that's where that came out, and that somehow put it in focus for us. And I think maybe for a lot of other people in the field, to say, yes, this is how these things are related at some level. That is, we have these axes, and you know, you can vary the various things, and they, you have this phenomenon around the origin, which is got these general behaviors, and you go far enough away, and you don't have those general behaviors anymore. And you know, so then to look at that, I think is kind of where for me, that gave me a point for which I could start to think. I've got next, just a moment. Okay. I forget where I was, but
how you know, putting the jamming phase diagram created a focus for both you and Andrea and many in the community.
Well, I don't know if it did for others in the community. I can't speak for others, but for us it did, and then we could begin to ask questions, and then we asked, look, if you have a diagram like this, then there got to be some point J in there. And if it's point J, then what are its properties? And you can do simulations in this in a very clean way. And so we could do this, and we could vary these things and begin to get clean results. And thank God we didn't put in friction, because then you'd never get clean results. And so, not that friction isn't important, but there were certain choices that we made that made it possible to say clean things about these cases, and we're able to get a certain distance.
And how did that collaboration work, right? You were two centers, fairly distant from one another.
Yeah, 2,000 miles apart. It was great because, you know, she was earlier than me. And so when 5 o'clock came around, my life became really calm here because no one was bothering me. And that was in the middle of her afternoon before she had to go home. And so it was, you know, we had, you know, it was great. We, you know, every day we would talk for hours at a time. And we hired a postdoc together, Corey O'Hearn. And it was just, you know, it was delightful. No one cared what we were doing. It was wonderful. It was the best time. No one gave a damn. It didn't matter whether we were saying important stuff or not important stuff, or, you know, is someone going to take us seriously or not? No, we weren't under the microscope for this. And then unfortunately, or fortunately, other people got interested, and then it became less fun because people are paying attention.
So this was all done over the phone, or the postdoc would travel back and forth? Or
it was all done over the phone. It was before Skype. It was before Zoom. It was just had it. Telephone. And telephone was great. I mean, it was, you could lie on the floor. No one would know you were lying on the floor. I mean, it was, whereas with Zoom, you can't lie on the floor anymore. I mean, it's a.
Another important notion that came out beyond the point J of this study is this notion of marginal stability. How did that come about in your work? How do you relate that? Did it also have deep roots in work you'd done before, or this was really a new idea that came out at that point?
Well, I think to a lot of what we were trying to understand, what is this crazy thing that we've got there? And we were struggling with it because, you know, you change the potential and everything changes, and that's not supposed to be the way phase transition works. And so how do you get this? And so we kind of tried to study this. We tried to study and we had finite size systems, and so nothing's at as finite as one place. The thing moves around depending on one, you know, what's next to what, slowly piecing these things together to realize, it's not the potentials that's right, it's somehow a length scale that's right. And where's the length scale? And then that was where Leo Silbert came in. So he was our postdoc too. And so he looked at the normal modes of these systems, which is something I learned from Anish Rahman way back when. That was one of the lasting things that I got from Anish. We looked at that and we realized, this is how you can begin to see that there are two length scales in the problem. There's a transverse and longitudinal length scale that you can get from this thing. And things began to fall into place, but you realized also that this density of states was flat all the way down to zero frequency. And nothing is supposed to be flat all the way down to zero frequency. I mean, that's not the way, in all the solid state courses I'd ever taken, I remember I took one from Leo Kadanoff, and he said, no, you can't get it going down to, it always has to go as omega to the d minus one or whatever. And here was behaving very, very differently. And so this is where we realized that, this is, the jamming point is in some sense a pole. It's a pole of disorder. It's the epitome of disorder. That is, you can't that you have got some length scale which has gotten larger than any system size when you've gotten down to that point. That correlation length then is, you can't get elasticity in the normal sense below that. And so there's some sense in which averaging doesn't work anymore. And so that's kind of where that aspect of the ideas came from. Mathieu Viard was here as a graduate student. And so he was working on some of these things. And you know, he also, you know, was thinking about marginality in terms of what happens with pressure. And so this is now what's happening, not exactly at the transition, which is kind of marginal, but away from it. And the small pressure things are going the system has to rearrange so it can withstand the pressure that is there. And so those are ideas that Mathieu has ownership of also in that. There are a lot of things that little pieces that come together here the idea of the length scales that we, and the fact that there are two of them is, was somehow, and still to me is puzzling in a way. And this is the thing that, I guess, you know, Andrea and I used to bemoan towards one another that, you know, God, why can't we find a spin model for this? Because then people would start to take us seriously. I mean, no one was paying any attention, you know. And we don't have a spin model. And if there's no spin model, no physicist is going to be interested. And that's basically true. But what I just realized is that, no, it's because there is no spin. I mean, there's something really fundamentally different about this transition than the spin ones. And this is, you asked earlier about relation to spin glasses and this, and it makes me think, well, no, there's something about jamming which is not in spins. And there's something fundamentally different here that we've gotten, we've got hold of the tail feathers a bit, and it's, those remarks I was trying to make earlier about that is that, you know, there is something new and different that's not just the spin glass, and because otherwise I would have had a model for this, but if you were going to make a model out of this and spins, it would be such a tortuous model, it would be so fake, no one particularly take it seriously. This is the right way to study this kind of transition. And to be honest, I'm not sure I know of other examples. I mean, I can get the critical phenomena of boiling and melting and freezing and so forth, and gas liquid, gas solid, all those transitions are just fine. I find spin models for those. I don't know of a spin model for the jamming part that kind of, you know, allows you to say at that transition, the long range interaction of this thing rearranges itself at the transition to make the transition is somehow new here in a way that's not quite the same.
Did you ever teach about structural glasses or jamming at Chicago or else?
Did I ever, pardon?
Teach.
I gave a couple of lectures. I mean, there was one thing at Eindhoven, which was a, they have these master classes, whatever. And then I came back to Chicago after that, and we were doing stuff on jamming as part of our MRSEC. And I was at some meeting, and I realized no one knew what jamming was. And so I then gave a whole bunch of lectures to teach jamming, you know, as we knew it then. This was a bunch of years ago. Mm-hmm. And then Giulio's Beggar Who. I gave some lectures there, and they're very nuts and boltsy because that's how I think. I mean, it's not the, you know, I'm sure it could be done in a much more fancy way, but that's kind of cool.
One can look through your career and your production as being expressed in sort of artful imagery, including coffee stain rings, figures and patterns revealed by pulling apart paint between plates, fluid droplet break off and splashing. Was your glass and jamming work part of that? Was there some aesthetic drive for you, or this was just separate?
Look, I think that aspect grew on me as time went on. There's at the beginning when I was just doing glassy stuff, probably not. I mean, I don't think that there was an aspect there that was had the visual appeal of what I'm after. One of the appeals of doing the granular work was that, I started to do granular stuff and I got to see it. I mean, and I really got to see the damn thing. I mean, it wasn't hidden behind anything. And I think mustard seeds are beautiful. They're just, you know, and watching the flow along the surface of the, that's really neat. I mean, I get excited about that in a way that I probably wouldn't have gotten excited if I'd seen a signal. I did get excited when I saw echoes, I have to admit, but here this is, and so the granular material was the beginning of saying, yeah, you can get the best of both worlds. I started out wanting to be a literature major, and I ended up in physics, which seemed to be as far away as I could get from that. But this let me have an entry back into the world of aesthetics in some sense. And so that was very important for me. And so I started off with the granular stuff because we were watching it and we could see it, and I didn't need terribly fast cameras and so forth. But then we got into the drop pinch off problem. And then we had to get really high speed cameras to start doing this and do photography with high speed strobes and so forth. And I love that. I mean, I'm just so sorry that they invented digital photography, because it was so much fun to do it, the old fashioned analog way. Yeah, it's not to say that digital photography isn't better, but as far as the enjoyment is for me, I just love doing the and going to the dark room and smelling all those chemicals.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
No, I mean, look, I didn't realize you were going to be asking all these questions, and I'm kind of in awe that you actually, someone looked back to see what I gave a talk on these things. Jesus, that's amazing. So thank you for having done that. It's certainly fun to look back at all of the work, and I feel a little bit bad in what I've said is that so many people have been important in this, in my career, and I have not been able to give appropriate credit to them in this somehow. I just started off talking about the ideas rather than all the people who helped. I mean, my graduate students, my postdocs have been great, and I managed to mention a few when we came along at certain topics, but really they were So I want to acknowledge all of them, and my colleagues have been great. And and I don't, we all take credit for ideas that somehow we had something to do with, but I can't take credit for most of these things. I mean, you know, the whole ideas of jamming and rheology and so forth, that we'd started this ITP workshop. Tom was involved in that. I mean, I don't think he gets enough credit for that. I mean, Sue was involved in that. All of these things, and so I feel guilty being the one being, asked about this, but all of these things really go to all these people. So that's, we've mentioned a lot about Andrea, so of course that's up front, and Corey, Leo, Silbert, and the atmosphere here. So that people let me do this, even though it was weird stuff. This was not supposed to be something a serious professor would do, and they let me do it. So I'm grateful.
In closing, have you kept notes, papers, or correspondence from over these times? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I think it all came from the time of email. I mean, so much of the
well, not your glasswork.
I mean, it's amazing how much we forget. I mean, I took a year off at one point, basically stopped doing research to take in a family from Cambodia during the, and I thought I would never forget that, because that was such an intense experience. I spent all the time doing it, and I can't even remember their names. I mean, it's just so yeah, I probably there's stuff around someplace, but where I find it, I'm not sure. I certainly haven't kept records of it in a in a well-defined venue. That's too bad.
Mr. Nagel, thank you very much for this conversation.
Well, thank you so much for thinking of me. So, thanks.